Welcome to our ninth lesson in the book of Revelation. I've entitled it The Church Cultural Perspective. Let's look at two slides from our previous lesson, where we talked about Christ being the first and last, the Alpha and Omega. Christ was the active agent, not of ex nihilo, borrowing matter out of nothing. That is the exclusive purview of the Father. But Christ is the active agent in bringing order out of chaos. The Father borrowed the material. The Son formed the material into planets, stars. You, me, plants, animals. And the physical interworkings of the entire universe is a result of the Son. He is the beginning of all things, but He springs from the Father. He is the monogenesis, the only begotten who was with the Father in eternity past, but came out from the Father to be the author and finisher, the beginning and end of our faith, our existence. It is Christ who made us. And Christ is also the Alpha of the New Covenant. He is the first fruit with the new body. And He will be there with us throughout eternity future, in which there is no end. So while this creation has a beginning and an end, and we, as created beings, have beginnings but no end, Christ had no beginning. He just changed to come out from the Father to be the interface between the Father and us. And as I stated, you and I, well, we had no say in our beginning. And we have no say, in actuality, on our death. Christ says, no one takes my life from me. I voluntarily lay it down when it's appropriate. And when was it appropriate to lay it down? When He, who knew no sin, became sin for us and bore the wrath of the Father so that we might become adopted sons of God forever. And of course, in our last lesson, we looked at the preamble. The end of the preamble, which is only the end of the beginning. It ends on a high note, glorifying Christ. And the church letters, well, we're going to see how they emphasize the failure of the church, just like the Jews failed in the Old Testament to witness to the nations, but they were a witness to the nations irregardless. These letters are going to show that the churches, fail to be the appropriate, proper witness to the people. The body of Revelation balances the failures of the lost with their ultimate second death, contrasted with the salvation of the saved, culminating in their second life. The Alpha, but this is the Omega. There's a time of judgment, accountability. You go for as long as you go, but there will always be that time of accountability, always, for the saved and the lost. course, as we saw, Christ, the Alpha and Omega, is the focus of every word, not just of Revelation, but of the Bible. Now, we've covered various perspectives already in our study of Revelation. Most people fail in their grasp of Revelation because they read into it. They take their perspective from their time period, whether it be the 19th century, 18th century, 15th century, or 21st century. And they read that into the book. And this is how we understand it. Unfortunately, it's incoherent. The deeper they dive into the scriptures, the more incoherent their forced perspective becomes. And they end up having to make it up as they go along. We've tried not to do that. Proper hermeneutics demands that we go back and look at every book from the perspective of the person who wrote it. Yes, God inspired them, but God inspired and used them in their particular historical, cultural, religious setting. Using words as they would have used them, not as we would define them today, especially not as we define them today, because we redefine them on the fly. Postmodernism is built on shifting sand. You can't rely on anything being firm and concrete and knowable. It's all unknowable by their own definition. And they bring that incoherence into everything. And modern churches are adopting it. And they bring their incoherence into the scriptures to make it mean what they want it to mean at that point in time. Well, we're going to see that that's not a new thing. We call it postmodernism because we're ignorant. And we measure everything in light of ourselves because evolution is viewed as upward in man's eyes. Whereas in actuality, evolution is a downward spiral from God's perspective. You only grow worse and worse and worse. You don't get better. There is no upward evolutionary process. There has been none found in nature. You kind of make it up as you go along. And any mutations that are discovered are downgrades, not upgrades. And we've looked at it from the historical perspective. We've looked at it from the mystery perspective. Today we're going to look at it from the cultural church perspective. Because this is the end of the first century. Significant changes have happened. This book was written in the 90s AD. Not the 1990s, the 90s. The end of the first century. Jerusalem, well, it's in shambles. The temple no longer exists. It's been destroyed. The Sadducees no longer function because without a temple, they have no purpose. The priesthood is gone. The Judaism that remains, even today, traces its lineage from the Pharisees and the synagogue system. And that means that the church that was at Jerusalem that we saw in the beginning of Acts is scattered. Now, it was beginning to be scattered in the book of Acts. That was the function of Saul He was one of the agents to scatter the church because they tended to want to stay clumped in Jerusalem, and they weren't really excited about going to Samaria and the othermost parts of the world. They didn't want to do that. So God had to help them. And Satan, well, he wasn't interested in helping them. He was just interested in stomping them out, which in the long run helped them. And so they scattered, and of course, that is the purpose of the book of Acts, is to show us this. And we see that for 3 years, Paul established a church at Ephesus. Not church in the sense as we would understand it today, you know, with its own dedicated buildings and parking lots and programs and billboards and flashy video signs and all this mess. He rented a teaching hall during the hottest part of the day, when nobody was doing anything, and that's when he taught. That's the dedication of these people. They took their afternoon siestas and stayed awake to come and learn about Christ. Because they would work into the night, so they were robbing themselves of sleep. They were robbing themselves of comfort to do this, to learn of Christ. And after AD 70, this area grew in importance as a foundation for preserving the gospel. And John moved here and headquartered here in Ephesus. But Judaism was not done with Christianity. There was a council of Yamnia. Now, in most languages, you don't pronounce the J as we do in English. So in English, you'd pronounce it Jumnia. But in most languages, the J is just like the H. It's just a breath sound. And it's Yamnia. And it declared the way, not Judaism. Now, the Romans were already getting onto this program back in the 50s under Nero, that this new sect, which they viewed as part of Judaism, was not really Judaism. And that's why under Nero, there was this half-hearted attempt at persecuting Christians, at least right around Rome. Remember, Rome, if you were not a sanctioned or legal religion, you were not allowed to exist. And if you came to the attention of the state and they looked in their books and you didn't have that caveat, you were executed. And the Jews here are officially declaring at this Council of Yamnia that the people of the way, Christians, are not of us. They're anathema. We reject them totally. Now, you can debate the effects of the council. You can debate all the other aspects that some authors have attributed to this council. I'm not saying that this council spoke for all Jews. I'm not saying that it was authoritative in any way. Because remember, Judaism is scattered now. And the Jews of the Diaspora back in the old Babylonian area, while they are much more powerful and influenced than these scattered Jews here in the Judea area, the Palestine area, as the Romans would call it, and as that area would henceforth be known even down to today. But what it does show is that the Jews have rejected, by their own admission, they have rejected Christ. They want nothing to do with Christ. And that has been true ever since. And so we see that from this time forward, the church concentrates on Gentiles. So it's not just the Gentiles hating the Jews because they kill Christ. And that's more of a medieval, late medieval thing. But it's the Jews hating Christ and not wanting any part of it, which is foretold by Paul already in the book of Romans, Romans 11. And we'll look at that toward the end of this lesson here. And so Christianity is not sanctioned by Rome, but it's not being actively persecuted by Rome, other than that sporadic attempt under Nero, which didn't last very long. But Ephesus is where they settled down at. First with Paul, then with John, and they moved out into all the world. Ephesus was on the seacoast in those days. It's maritime, trade, booming. And so Christians would be able to take ship across the Aegean into Greece. They would go across the Mediterranean to Crete, to Cyprus, to North Africa, to Alexandria. These were thriving areas, even on into Spain. Paul himself said he wanted to go to Spain. And there's no record he went, but there's no record he didn't. We know that Peter went to Babylon and came back. But we know that Ephesus was a religious city. They had the Temple of Artemis, known as Diana of Ephesus. Not to be confused with Diana of Hellenism, though they're all the gods and goddesses of all the ancient cultures, though they appear specific to that culture, have general characteristics in common with each other because they come from one source, at Babel. They've just been modified to fit their cultural worldview. And as these cultures age and become more separated and distinct from each other, so do these gods and goddesses become more distinct, appear more different. Though at the foundational level, they all share common characteristics. If you go to Acts 19, and we'll turn there, we see in this book that Paul's preaching was so pervasive that there's a riot. About that time, there arose no little disturbance concerning the way. And that was the label for Christianity before they became known as Christians. They were just people of the way. We don't use that terminology today. But we should, because we are on the way. This creation is nothing more than a journey. We are passing through. Like Ibrahim, we are looking for a city to come. So we are on the way, the road, the path, the hohados in the Greek, or hadarek in the Hebrew. See, even the Jews knew that they were on the path. They were on the road. They were on the way. They just wanted to stay here because they got confused. But we're going to see here in Revelation that the church is confused, and it wants to stay here. It wants to get off the road, stay at the inn, and build their home here. God says, that's not going to help you because this is not going to last. It's going to go away. He's already talked about it in Hebrews. Christ already talked about that in the Gospels. But that's what the lost do. That's what the immature do. They become confused and they want to stay. And we talked about this in our study of Job. Jude. So there was, for a man named Demetrius, a silversmith who made silver shrines of Artemis, otherwise known as Diana, brought no little business to the craftsmen. But business is declining because people not buying these things. And as Paul's teaching goes out into the community and out into the surrounding areas, and businessmen come in. Oh, yeah, it's church like back home. Yeah, let me go listen. Let me go here. Or did you say it was not? Yeah, let me go to this place and listen. Wow, I like what he's saying. The Spirit's moving upon them. They don't want the shrines. They don't want the little doodahs. They don't want the little icons. Just think of it as taking the place of your cell phone. You got your little icon in your hand and you're stroking it and it makes you feel a bit better and it helps you focus your thoughts. They knew the goddess, this little icon, was not the goddess. They knew the big statue of which this was just a representation was not the goddess. But it focused their mind just like your little iPad, iPhone, Android phone focuses your mind on your idol. Self. Anyway, there was a riot. For 2 hours, they just screamed out, "Great is Artemis, great is Diana of the Ephesians, great is, great is, great is." Because Ephesus was the custodian of this temple. Now, we need to recognize that Patmos is a title, not a name. John, we're sending you to Patmos. We don't like you. You're a troublemaker. And off you go. You're being exiled to Patmos. Probably was not the name of the island in those days. And who cares what the name was? The name was unimportant. John gave it a title. A title is the island of my death. That's what Patmos means, my death. He saw that as a place where he was going to go to die. Because it was a penal island. And you get sent there to do hard labor till you die. And Rome was infamous for doing this. If you're niggardly or of no account, and niggardly is not a racist word, it is an English word meaning of no account, which is kind of why the word was used. But we need to not become inflammatory in our language such that we reduce our language to just four-letter curse words all the time, because that's how people speak now. Even Christians have become so coarse in their language that they just flow off their lips because they have no language. They have allowed their language to be stolen from them. And they've been reduced to thinking in perverse four-letter words that are so abstract as to have almost no meaning other than to course in your viewpoint. We don't want to be like that. Because the more that we allow our language to be stolen from us, the less able we are to communicate effectively. And the important part is the less able you are to understand the scriptures as you read them, even in your own language. So the Romans loved to take political prisoners and exile them to these islands. And oftentimes it was just hard labor. Well, I'm not going to execute you. I'm not going to get your rivals, your supporters upset at me, but we're going to exile you out here to this island where, first of all, it's an island, so we control the access. You can't be a troublemaker anymore. And saying you got to earn your keep. So you either got to pay us money to feed you, or you're just going to have to work till you die. And so it was one of the islands, many islands that dotted the coastline off of in the Aegean area. And he was sent there to die. And he recognized that. John's elderly man here. He's in his 70s, 80s, 90s. And evidently, he did something to get himself exiled. Now, we don't know exactly what. We can theorize, and I'll give you my perspective on this. Ephesus was known as a Nekoros, or Neokoros city. Neokoros is a temple guardian. This city was the guardian or gatekeeper for the temple of Artemis, of Diane. Well, about this time, they were also building another temple to the current Roman Emperor Domitian. Or Domitian. Take your pick. And they did this so that he would also declare them to be a Neokoros of himself. The guardian of his memory. And they did this to gain a special status above other cities. Now, this is not unusual. American cities in the 19th and 20th century were constantly trying to booster themselves. Come visit our town. This is what makes us special. We're the land of the strawberries. We have the blueberry festival. We have the jazz festival. Rembrandt died here. Woisenin slept there. And whatever they can make up. We are the... St. Louis, we built an arch. You could come visit our arch. Why you'd want to do so is another matter. But you can go visit their arch. If you don't get mugged and robbed and beaten in the process of getting in and getting out of there. This is just how cities tried to differentiate themselves to invite in business and tourist trade, because business, money, tourists, money. And we see this in the medieval periods. What caused most of the cathedrals to be built, even though it took them 100 years or more to build one of those things, was not their devotion. It was to attract business and tourists. And they would house relics. A piece of bone that belonged to Peter, maybe, or a piece of wood that was of the cross, or whatever else that they could make up. And people would flock there. And that's dirty little secret of Catholic cathedrals, is that's why they were built, to attract tourism, to attract business, to make that area grow. And when it was successful in one city, another one down the road or in another country would see that and say, well, we're going to build a bigger one. We're going to build a better one. Well, there's nothing new under the sun. Ephesus was already doing it. And they weren't the only ones. The seven wonders of the world were about building to attract business and tourists. Especially important with Domitian, because he was not a popular emperor. His brother Titus died, and he died with on his lips saying, "There's one thing left undone that I should have done." But he died, and so nobody knew what it was. They theorized it was, "I should have killed my brother who just killed me." So whether he did or not, Domitian carried this cloud of doubt as to whether he was really a proper emperor now, or whether he just killed his way to the throne. And he wasn't trained to be emperor as his brother was. So he really didn't know how to operate the reins of power very well. He's easily manipulated. He was not a military type of emperor, though he tried to pretend to be. Of course, every time you try to pretend, everyone who actually knows how to do that job knows you're lying. They see right through you, and you're insecure, and thus you become super sensitive to slights. And Domitian was a terror to the rich and powerful in Rome. And those who were Roman and rich and powerful that might take his place or might want to have him assassinated. And so he was constantly showing how powerful he was by terrorizing others, by exiling them to Patmos. But there's no indication that Domitian even had a glimpse or an understanding of the sect of the way, that he was the author of some centralized, overarching persecution of Christians, none that I could find. That was going to come in two or three decades later under a different emperor. So it's theorized that John spoke out against this temple to a man. And he would have. I mean, he was spoken out against the temple of Artemis also. It was already built. People were going there, and you know, you teach not to believe in idols. Obviously, because there is no idols. There is only one God. That is Lord Jesus Christ. But when you take a man and you build a temple to him to deify him, you're going to speak out directly against that. And that's not going to go well for you. Not because Domitian would have heard of this and said, kill him. Because once again, we have no scriptural historical evidence that anything like that had occurred. However, he would have offended the local governments. Because we have to remember is that because Domitian was arbitrary and capricious in his frequent retributions, until indeed, in fact, he himself was killed, assassinated, this type of rule promotes an especially godless society. Now, by godless, I don't mean out of control debauchery, but pagan societies had open sexuality. They would never have understood this today's problem with LGBTQA+, whatever, because all these things were just normal. You slept with whomever you wanted to sleep with. Women were for making children. Men were for each other, for pleasure. Boys, children, babies, didn't matter. Animals, didn't matter. They wouldn't have understood any of this. Open nudity was a given. It wouldn't have attracted any special attention. It was that debased a society. And if you wanted to get a prostitute, you didn't go to the back slums to find one. You didn't sneak around. You went down to the local temple and rented a priestess. And that was your form of worship to that particular deity, whether it was a man or a woman. And so, according to Proverbs 20:21, 29:12, and 30:27, it is this kind of leadership that promotes decrepit, debased societies. They're in a downward spiral. And it permeates throughout the entire empire. So here we are in Ephesus, already a godless society, and proud of it, enough so that they are willing to risk the wrath of Rome. Having a 2-3 hour riot in this major city would attract the attention of Rome, and they would have stationed a military garrison there. They would have removed from you your ability to govern yourself and given you a military dictator to prevent this kind of thing from happening again. Rome is very sensitive to these kinds of outbursts and very ham-fisted, iron-fisted approach to dealing with it. And that's why, when you go and you read in the book of Acts, chapter 19, the governor of the city is saying, we are in danger of being questioned and called out about this. And you all know what that would mean. That would not be a good thing for anybody here. So John spoke out against this building of this temple and this worshiping of a man. But he's the head of, not really the head, but he is one of the founders, Mary's apostle, of a non-state approved religion. And so, Ephesus would have exiled them. They could have just executed on the spot, but you don't want to cause another riot, you don't want to cause retribution. Sometimes just moving them out of the way. Removing them so they don't have a platform and you don't make them a hero. So they sent him off to a penal island instead for him to work himself to death. Now the apostles never exalted themselves after Christ. Well, they were disciples with Christ. Yes, they were arguing about who was first, who was second. And John was always in the midst of that. In Matthew 23:8-12, just before he went to the Stauros, Christ told them, stop it. You're not teachers. You don't take titles. You're not to be called rabbi or the teacher. Which, if you remember that, and then you go to John 3, when Christ tells Nicodemus, so you are the teacher of Israel, are you? You begin to see a little sardonic flavor to that question there. So you're the teacher of Israel, huh? You got a few problems in your understanding, bud, in your theology. But Christ is telling his apostles here, you're not to seek after these titles because you don't have, you're not the teacher, number one. I'm the teacher. And the Spirit, I will send you the Spirit from me to you, and he will teach you about me. You will always be students. I will always be the teacher. And so you don't see any of the apostles rising up and lording over, even in Acts 15, at the First Church Council, as it's usually called. It's being chaired not by Peter, but by James, who's not even an apostle. He's the brother of Christ. And he's not chairing it because he's the brother of Christ. He's chairing it because he's the most devoted in prayer and study. And they listened to him. Because he who leads must first serve. Howard, the church is going to forget this, obviously, and we're going to see this in the church letters. The church hierarchy ends up making these offices, such as pope, bishop, priest, pastor, elder, in positions of leadership, positions of authority. And that's not going to work out well for them. So the way, the ho hados, the way of persecution, because that's what it was. I'm always amused today when you hear that the charge against the apostles building their own religion. Of course they would lie about Jesus. Of course they would do this because they were going to get rich. Did you study any of the lives of these people? They didn't get rich. Most of them died horribly. They did without. Paul talks about it. I've been beaten. I've been in the arena with trying defending myself against animals. I've been shipwrecked 3 times. Paul said, you think I'm doing this for the money? You think I'm doing this for the power and prestige? Well, the people I'm preaching to hate my guts. They laugh in my face. These people never read the scriptures. They look from sitting on the rear ends from their 20th, 21st century perspective and throw down these charges everyone agrees with without any bit of scholarship. And they point to the church and churches and denominations that have violated the very teachings of Scripture. These are charges against a false religionist, not true Christianity. But they conflate the two together, and they excuse the false religionist and condemn the true faith. So Christianity, remember, it's an illegal religion, separated from Judaism now, and it's in a precarious position. Tolerated if it remained in the shadows, as long as it did not oppose popular or official policies. But if it entered the limelight, its leaders and members could be prosecuted as a danger to state order, especially now with the growing of emperor worship for state cohesion. See, Rome allowed these certain religions, these approved religions, as long as you burnt a pinch of incense once a year to the emperor. Now, the emperor in and of himself was not considered divine in the first century. They were only made divine from time to time, since Augustus, after they were dead. But Domitian was going to kind of take that title on to himself while he was alive. Didn't stick very long because the moment he was assassinated, the senators ran out and started taking his name and likeness down from everything. So much so that it was hard to even know that he was an emperor for the longest time. But later on in the second century, living emperors would take these honors on to themselves and declare themselves divine. So we see here in this period of time, you have this generalized, insidious cultural tribulation. You have active hostility from the Jews. But they had to be careful because from time to time they would find themselves persecuted by Rome also. But they were not above leading cities into riots against these competitors for the faith, as we see from time to time in the book of Acts. But this paganism is coming to a close. It is in this time period with the growth of Christianity that paganism is drawing to a close. Now, it's not just the rise of Christianity. Something is happening behind the scenes that we're not going to get to until chapter 12 of Revelation. But it has already occurred at the death of Christ, at the Stavros. And thus the world is changing. It's not changing overnight. It's not changing in a blinding flash. But it is changing. That which was considered the ancient world is drawing to a close, and it's not going quietly. And that which will become known as the modern era is beginning to germinate. And it will grow throughout medievalism and spring forth full flower in the Enlightenment. But like I said earlier, there's nothing new under the sun. It's the same influences, it's the same sins, it's the same responses, just in different stage dressing. So John identifies his situation with this generalized, insidious, cultural tribulation. He's not saying it's coming from Rome. He's not saying the authorities are searching them out and killing them wholesale. Nothing like that. But he's saying that I am being persecuted. Not persecuted, but I am experiencing tribulation. Thlipsis, this pressing down, because I am teaching the gospel. I am teaching the word of Christ and the kingdom of Christ. And it opposes paganism. It opposes idolatry. It opposes man-centered worship. It does not oppose the state of Rome. Because we don't rebel. We're not leading rebellion. We're not rising up against Rome. Christ said it time and time and time again. The entire Old Testament is about do not rebel. God didn't even allow the Hebrews to rebel and march out of Egypt. They left under the guidance of God when Pharaoh told them to go. There was no rebellion. There's no rebellion at all in the Bible on God's part. Rebellion is all on sin's part. So he's exiled for spreading the gospel and teaching of Jesus' kingdom. Verse this recalls to mind John 18, 33 through 38. And let's go there. And this is Christ standing before Pilate. And then they led Jesus from the house of Caiaphas to the governor's headquarters. And so Pilate entered his headquarters, down in 33, and called Jesus and said to him, "Are you a king? Because that's what they're telling me here. Now, if you're a king, I can execute you. That'd be all right." He says, "Are you saying this because you got evidence, or you just a parrot and you're repeating what it is you're told?" Finally gets a little ticked at this charge. He said, "Do I look like a Jew? Come on now. Your own nation and chief priests have delivered you over to me. So what have you done? How have you ticked them off?" Because Pilate understands. He has negotiated with these people before and lost. He knows how good they are. So he's telling Jesus, "What did you do that they want you out of the way?" Now, this is exactly what's happening to John. What did you do that they exiled you to Patmos? See, here it's not Rome that wants to kill Jesus. It's the insidious, godless culture he's in. His own culture. Those who are supposedly representing God. This is the insidious tribulation. And Christ says, my kingdom is not of this world. It's not from this world. The apostle says, okay, I don't have a problem then. You can go teach whatever you want to. I've come into the world to bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice. And of course, Pilate then asks the famous question, what is truth? Because the lost cannot answer that question. Oh, they answer it, and they change it constantly because they have no truth. The truth is not in them. And that's what's happening here. What is truth? The truth is the gospel. The truth is the scriptures. The truth is the coming kingdom of God, which underlies this entire creation. It is the purpose of this entire creation. And so, this persecution is not centrally mandated, but emanated from local societal governing religious levels. Darkness rejecting light, and more so, as it sees the judgment approaching. So John says, I was in the Spirit on the Lord's Day. Now, we theorize this is probably Sunday. What does this in the Spirit mean? It sounds strange to us. It shouldn't, but it does. What is in the Spirit? Well, is he writing that he's in some trance, that he's meditating, and he's just, ooh, and he's just communing with God and nature, and it's all here, and I feel him around me? No. Neither is he babbling in tongues and rolling around on the ground as some charismatic Pentecostal doodah. He's not communing with some chakra, penile gland, third eye, Gnostic issue. What John is simply saying here is that he was not grieving or quenching the Holy Spirit. John's on this island to die. He knows that. That's why he writes, that's why he gave the island the title in the opening here, Patmos. I'm here to die. That's why they sent me here. It's not a fun place. And what's he doing? He's praying. He's not screaming to God. He's not quenching the Spirit. He's not cursing God. He's not, oh, the Bible didn't work and God hates me and they're all against me and I'm waiting. No, he's praying. Why? Well, let's see. Paul was beheaded. Peter was beheaded. James the Apostle was beheaded. Thomas went to India, probably. And yeah, he died there. And there's a guy who went to North Africa, and he didn't last long. He's the last one. They've all been executed. They've all been murdered. Ain't not one of them died of old age. He's simply worshiping Jesus. That's all he's doing. He's praying. He's worshiping via the Spirit rather than blaming Jesus for his banishment. The world hates you. If you think that you're going to go to church and go to work and speak Jesus and live Jesus, and the world is going to love you and run and worship at your feet, you haven't read the Bible. And you're not really talking to people. Because that's not how it works. They don't like you. They may have to tolerate you, but they don't like you. But this mindset is not reserved for Sunday. He's just able to get a break from labor, I guess, on this time for worship. But this is supposed to be our constant frame of mind, always in a state of worship. In fact, everybody is always in a state of worship. The only question is, what are you worshiping? Flesh or faith? Satan or Christ? Self or the Spirit? What are you worshiping? What informs your values? That tells you what you're worshiping. Are you excusing your sin? Then you're not worshiping Jesus. Are you upset with Jesus because of your situation? Then you're not worshiping Jesus. You're worshiping self. This is probably in prayer when Christ appeared. If you turn to Romans 8, 22 through 27, you'll see that all prayer is carried from us to the Father via the Spirit, based on the work of the Son. In fact, sometimes we don't even know how to pray or what to pray for. And so whatever it is we're babbling, the Spirit's just saying, we're going to ignore that. We're going to actually do this instead. We're going to say this because this is what he needs or she needs. And John hears a voice. But not just a voice. He hears a voice guaranteed to gain his attention. A trumpet blast. Now, a trumpet in the Old Testament was always a signal. Because trumpets in those days only blasted one note. It was a call to attack. It was a call to move. It was a call to stop. It was a call to gain your attention so that you heard the next command. And the next command here was right. It wasn't lead a rebellion. It wasn't to gather an army. It was to right. Because the Father and the Son and the Spirit only work through words. And I'm going to tell you a little secret. The only power Satan has, because he has no magic, he has no other power. The only power he has is through his words, his lying words. It's always about the words. And it reminds us both of Paul, who writes in 1 Thessalonians 4, 15 through 18, that the Lord himself will descend with a shout, with the voice of a trumpet, like an archangel. Roar! Hear! And everyone will hear that voice. Everyone will hear that voice who is saved. And they will rise to meet him in the air. The dead first, then the alive, those who are alive, and they will receive their new bodies. Their salvation will be complete. And it will open up the time that Revelation is going to address. But also at Mount Horeb, the Father, in Exodus 19 and 20, the voice of a trumpet, the trumpet blasts as he descended in power on the mountain with thunders and lightnings and clouds. Remember we talked about clouds? Well, here's the trumpet blast to go with those clouds. And in that trumpet blast, he calls Moses up to talk to him. And those trumpet blasts blasted out 10 words, and the people trembled. This is the final revelation, ending what began with Moses, the composer of the Pentateuch. It said, John saw the holy priest, Jesus, instead of holy fire the burning bush. Moses just saw a flame. The people just saw a flame, cloud by day, flame by night. That was Christ. But John sees Christ, the high priest. And what is he to write? What you see. John's not to add his interpretation or theories. That is, he's not to change Jesus' word. And Jesus closes the book saying, no one has authority to change this word. Not just the Revelation book, but the entire Bible. It fulfilled Christ's words to Peter about John. Let's go to John 21. Starting verse 20 through 23. You know the situation. Peter had denied Christ three times, and later on, Jesus says, you're going to meet me in Galilee, and here they are. They're meeting him in Galilee, and Jesus pulls Peter aside and says, Peter, do you love me? Feed my sheep. Three times, and he's just beside himself. But this is the call. Peter, you betrayed me. I forgive you. Are you going to be able to do this job? Do you want to do this job? You're going to die doing this job, just so you know. And Christ tells him that. In the preceding verses here, when he says, you used to dress yourself and walk wherever you wanted, but when you are old, you will stretch out your hands and another will dress you and carry you where you do not want to go. Of course, this is where he's executed under Nero. Then he says, but follow me. But Peter, being the kind of guy he was, turned and looked at John, the youngest of the apostles, and said, well, tell me about this guy. What's his future going to be? And I imagine he's going to end up pointing to all of them because that's Peter's curious guy. And of course, it's about John. And Jesus said to him, if it is my will that he remain until I come, what is that to you? You follow me. It doesn't matter what I have him do. It only matters to you what I have you do. And this is a fulfillment. John, in his old age, gets to see Christ. Like Christ said, if it is my will, he remain until I come. Well, John is alive and Jesus has come. Now, he hasn't come to the whole world. He came to John. And John remained alive until he came. And here he is revealed to John on the island of his death. Didn't say that John would live forever. And John obviously says that toward the end of the gospel there. And Jesus says, write what you see in a book to the seven churches, and he names the churches, and we're not going to go through all the names. We'll do that when we go through each church. But notice what's missing. Jerusalem is missing. He's concentrating on the churches in Asia because Jerusalem is suspended. The Jews and God's working and just working through the Jews is suspended until events detailed later in Revelation. It is now our time to be witnesses, which the Jews failed. They were to be witnesses throughout the nations, but they failed. But the letters to the churches will detail how we will fail, and we have failed. Now, you can go read in Romans 11, the entire chapter, in which Paul goes into some detail explaining this and warning the church people, the Christians, to not fall into the same trap, which they immediately do. Because people, we're all the same. Galatians 4, 21 through 31, Paul talks about how earthly Jerusalem represents the law. It represents slavery to sin. It represents failure. We are to look for a heavenly Jerusalem, like Abraham. Like the end of Revelation, the earth, the heavenly Jerusalem that comes down. That is our city. That is our goal. That is where our eyes should be fixated upon. So these churches were the hub of Christianity in John's time. Now, the second century would see Christianity's focus shift to North Africa because Romans. As Rome became untenable and unbearable a place to live and dangerous too, with these crazy emperors saying they're gods and doing very strange stuff, they would take their money and flock to North Africa, which was the new garden spot of the world. Now, we don't see that today because under Islam and 2 millennia of changing climate issues, Africa, North Africa, is not considered a dream vacation spot as it used to be 2 millennia ago. But they did. And those were the churches that gave rise to Augustine or Augustine and others and vied with Rome for supremacy in the gospel and in understanding and in theology. But not in this day. This day it is Asia. It's not Jerusalem. It's in Asia. And Asia was a Roman province. It doesn't mean all of Asia from Turkey to Japan. That's not what it means. It means the province of Asia, which is the western part of modern Turkey. Jewish and pagan hostility toward the way were populist movements supported by local governments, because local governments are offices are held by local people. They bring their prejudices and whatever into it, and they're in those offices not because of force, but because of they represent the popular opinion. So I believe these letters to the churches that we're going to study reflect the various responses to this generalized persecution. As I said, there's no evidence Domitian initiated an empire-wide Christian persecution movement. These letters detail the church's greater failure. We have the indwelling spirit and a longer time span. And yet we have failed more completely. The churches, composed of believers and lost, respond in like manner, adopting current philosophies to blend in, which moves them away from their changeless Melchizedek high priest, Jesus, or Christ. And we want to understand that, because this is whom John sees. Now, we're going to step off reality henceforth. This is probably our last set of verses here in what we would call concrete reality. And, of course, we're studying verses 9 through 11. Because henceforth, we're going to be stepping behind the curtain. We're not going to ignore the man behind the curtain, the reference to us. We're going to be going behind the curtain with the one behind the curtain, which is Christ, to show us not only what is coming how it's coming, why it's coming, and the most important and timeless aspects and the spiritual aspects. It is coming. It has been growing. And we can point back through history and see these very same influences growing in the last two millennia. Even today, especially today. And so we're not stepping off the end of the world, the edge of the world here, where there'd be monsters and we can make it up as we go along. We're stepping out behind the facade of what we call reality, the physical reality. Remember, Hebrews 11:3, that which is seen is made from that which is not seen. Well, we're going to get to see what's usually not seen. But we have to be careful that we don't make it up. That we don't fall into the trap others have. That we don't make it specific to our time. That we stay grounded in the Word of God, and let Scripture interpret Scripture. Thank you.